the other. He reached the front door, eased it open, and followed the dog out. He closed the door, but left it ajar. Rocky made a break for the lawn, pulling Teddy off the porch. He followed the dog to the side of the lawn, where Rocky peed on a bush. Dino loomed up out of the dark.
"Need a hand?"
he whispered. "Give me the spare collar." Dino held Rocky while Teddy snapped the new collar they'd brought around his neck, clipped the leash to it, then unsnapped Rocky's original collar.
"Okay," Teddy said. "You guys are set. I'll meet you back at the car."
Dino took the leash and led Rocky off, or rather, Rocky led him. Teddy hurried back around the corner to the SUV, where Barkley was sitting alertly in his crate. Teddy opened the crate door and slipped Rocky's collar around his neck. Barkley jumped out, sniffing the air. Clearly, he smelled another dog, but Dino had led Rocky far enough away that it wasn't a problem. Teddy was able to distract Barkley with treats and led him to the front door. Teddy eased the door open, snapped on the penlight beam, and made his way to the kitchen. Barkley was happy to go. He seemed more manageable than Rocky. Teddy wondered if the handler would notice. The crate door was open. Barkley walked right in. Teddy unsnapped the leash, tossed Barkley a few treats to keep him happy, and turned to go. A light came on in the house. Teddy could hear the sound of footsteps coming down the stairs from the second floor. The stairs were between the kitchen and the foyer, so Teddy couldn't get out. There was the kitchen door, but the goon's chair was blocking it. There was a pantry off the kitchen, not a full pantry, just an alcove with shelves and no door. Teddy slipped in and tried to flatten himself against the side wall. The kitchen light snapped on. Barkley sprang up, wagging his tail. The handler stood in the doorway.
"I'm not taking you out again. I just took you out. You need to settle down. I'll give you a treat and you lie down. That's the deal. Take it or leave it."
The handler took a treat from a paper bag on the table, walked over and held it out for the dog. Barkley slurped it gratefully, wagging his tail, sat and waited for another. Teddy held his breath. If sitting for a treat wasn't one of Rocky's behaviors, the handler would notice. And Teddy's right shoulder was visible in the pantry alcove if the handler glanced in that direction. The handler looked the crate up and down as if something seemed to be different. He must have decided there wasn't. He frowned, shrugged, turned to go. The dog barked. The handler turned back and put up his hand, palm out.
"Rocky, stay."
It was a universal dog command. Barkley knew it too. He stopped complaining and accepted the fact that he was being left. The handler gave him one last look and switched off the light. Teddy breathed again. He stuck his head out from the pantry alcove and listened to the handler's footsteps heading down the hall. The stairs creaked as he plodded up them. The upstairs light went out. Teddy gave it another minute. The handler was probably still awake, but Teddy had to get moving. At least this time he wasn't taking a dog. He switched on the penlight to make sure he wouldn't knock anything over and made his way to the front door. He eased it open, slipped out, and shut it gently behind him. The goon was still sitting on his chair, looking to all intents and purposes like a guard who'd fallen asleep at his post. Teddy hurried across the lawn to the car. Dino started the engine and pulled out.
"I saw lights come on in the house. Did you wake the handler?"
Barkley woke the handler. He wasn't keen on being left alone.
"Is he going to give the game away?"
"I didn't have time to teach him his lines."
Dino drove back to the apartment. Teddy went in and got the dog handler.
"Be careful taking him out of the crate," Teddy warned. "He's a little hyped up from the tests."
As if to demonstrate
Rocky took a flying leap out of the back of the SUV and tried to hurtle down the street.
"What did you do to him?"
the handler said, bracing his feet and restraining the dog.
"Don't worry, the drugs will wear off."
"Drugs? I'm kidding. He's just glad to see you." The handler got control of Rocky. He took him for a short walk, brought him back, and went inside, all without noticing he was walking another dog entirely. Teddy and Dino set up the crate and took off before the handler could ask any more questions. Teddy smiled at Dino.
"Okay, we saved the world from extinction. Let's get the guys who are trying to do it."
79. Teddy called Mike Freeman at his office in New York.
"You know who this is?"
"I understand my men didn't. You're very good at what you do."
"Sometimes it's a curse. I need them to do something for me, and they'll have to hear it from you."
"Name it."
"There are some Syrians in Paris for a rare animal convention. Their leader is a strong man named Fahd Kassin. They've got a private plane out at the airport. I need your boys to locate it."
"Without anyone knowing they're looking?"
"That would defeat the whole purpose."
"I figured it would."
"Will that be a problem?"
"Hell no. It will give them something to do. Anything else I can do for you?"
"When they find out, it would be nice if they told me. I'd hate to have to call you to get the information."
"No problem. Just tell them Ice-9 Brushfire."
"That's the password?"
"It will be."
"How will I know when they have it?"
"Give them a couple of hours. If they haven't found it by then, it isn't there."
80. Teddy, dressed as an aviation mechanic, walked down the runway in front of the hangars. Mike Freeman's agents had done a good job. The plane was there, housed in Hangar 47, and the pilot in charge of the plane liked to pass the time playing pinochle with the pilots in the hangar next door. Teddy was pleased to see the game was in full swing. He walked by Hangar 47, turned, and walked around toward the back. He would have liked a window, but you can't always get what you want. The walls were solid, with only a small ventilation duct near the roof. The hangar doors were the only way in and out. It was a coin flip. No one was watching. Did he creep quietly around the corner of the building and slip in the front door? Or did he walk by bold as brass and amble in as if he had every right to do so? The latter seemed the better approach. If seen, he could pretend he'd accidentally entered the wrong hangar. That wouldn't work if he was seen sneaking in. Teddy walked in purposefully as if he worked there. No one challenged him. They were all playing cards. The Syrian's plane would have been dwarfed next to the Strategic Services jet. It looked like a 12-seater at best, with none of the amenities. Teddy smiled. He could imagine Fahd being pissed off that he hadn't been given better. The ladder was in place, and the door was open. Teddy waited to see if there was anyone inside. When he was reasonably certain there wasn't, he climbed the steps and went on board. Teddy's estimate had been accurate. It appeared they had been 6 rows of seats, though now there were only 5, 2 to a row, 1 on each side of the aisle. Teddy crept down the aisle. Sure enough, there on the floor were the holes where the back row had been unbolted and lifted out, probably to make room for a dog crate. Apparently the Syrians had counted on winning the bid. Teddy heard brisk footsteps as a man came into the hangar, and he ducked down in the plane. He scooted next to a window and peered out quickly. It was the Syrian pilot, and Teddy was trapped. There was no way he could get out, and no reasonable explanation for why he was there. He glanced around.
There was an access panel in the back of the plane. Teddy made for it, and wrenched it open to find a luggage compartment. He crawled in and pulled the door shut behind him just as the pilot came up the steps to the plane. Teddy could hear the steps of the pilot coming down the aisle and realized with dismay that he'd left the hatch ajar. If the pilot noticed, he'd close it, but he'd probably look in first. Would it be dark enough that the man wouldn't see him? Yet another in an endless stream of potential disasters. Teddy scrunched back in the darkness and bumped into the hull. He saw a crack of light. There was another hatch door. The cargo hold could be accessed from inside or out. He searched for a handle and found one, probably installed to ensure against anyone getting locked inside. Teddy pushed the hatch open. It was on the opposite side of the passenger door. He squirmed through and dropped to the concrete hangar floor. The pilot had not investigated the luggage hold. He was just going down the steps. Teddy crouched behind an oil drum until the pilot left the hangar again. He gave it 2 more minutes and snuck out. Teddy sighed and shook his head. This was not going to be easy. 81. Teddy checked his messages in the lobby of the pier. There was an encrypted email from Millie. Teddy decoded it. It read, "Lance wants to know when he can get the dog back. It belongs to a friend of his." Teddy sent her a message. "Prepare the friend for bad news." Millie emailed back, "What happened to the dog?" Teddy sent, "Nothing yet." Teddy logged off the computer, cursed Lance, and went to the front desk. "I'm Devin Billingham. I'd like to get my trunk out of the hotel safe." Teddy had the trunk brought up to his room. After the bellboy had left, he opened it up, took out his equipment bag, and set it on the bed. He sorted through and selected a few items that he stowed in his jacket pocket. He repacked the trunk, returned it to the desk manager to store in the hotel safe, and strolled back out again. 82. Dino returned from his meeting with the prefect.
"Is everything all set?" Teddy asked.
"Almost."
"What's wrong?"
"He's good on everything except letting the Syrians get away. He wants to arrest them, too."
"I had a feeling he might."
"He'd like to catch them with the dog. That will complete all the links in the chain."
"It would if I hadn't switched dogs. Catching them with Barclay isn't going to be good for anyone, except Lance. His buddy wants the dog back."
"Are you kidding me?"
"If only," Teddy sighed. "I take it this is a deal-breaker."
"There's no deal to break," Dino said. "The Paris police have all the information. He's going to move on it."
"Okay. Time for a little razzle-dazzle."
"What?"
"A little hocus-pocus, a little bait-and-switch, a little skin game."
"What do you have in mind?"
"Look, 2 out of 3's not bad, right?"
"It depends what you're talking about."
"I'm talking about your friend, the prefect of police."
"I thought you were. I'm not going to like this, am I?"
"You're going to love it, and so will he. After all, you're doing him a favor. If he winds up nailing a mad scientist and the silver fox, he's not going to feel that bad about the dog. He'll be too busy taking bows to give it any thought." Dino groaned.
"What do I have to do?"
"You have to pull a scam on the prefect."
"I don't think I can do that."
"Sure you can. You just need to keep him from showing up at the airport."
"How?"
"Here's the story. You got a tip from your source that the Syrians are picking up the dog at the handler's house the morning after the conference. If he wants to take out both ends of the operation, he should arrest them there. He'll get the Syrians, the dog, and the handler who was housing him.
At the same time, he hits the scientist's lab and René D'Argent's office. He has to do it all at once, so no one is tipped off. The beauty of that is, he'll want to be personally involved in the arrest of René D'Argent, which means he won't be one of the cops busting an empty house.
As if that makes it all better, Dino said dryly. If he doesn't get the dog, there's no connection between René D'Argent and the Syrians, and René D'Argent walks, and the scientist walks, and the Syrians get away. Everyone gets away except me. I'll probably get the guillotine.
I think they stopped using that.
I'm not eager to find out.
Dino spread his arms.
I'm right, aren't I? Without the dog, the prefect's got nothing on René D'Argent.
That's probably true, Teddy admitted.
So?
So let's get something. 83. It took Teddy 45 minutes to break into Kelso Labs. The majority of that time was spent disabling the security system. The main system wasn't hard, but they had more backup systems than Fort Knox. Once the last alarm was silenced and the last camera was turned off, it was a simple matter of picking a lock. Teddy entered through a maintenance door and followed the back hallway to the main corridor. Dr. Stefan von Heinrich's lab was the third door on the left. Just in case there was any doubt, the good doctor had slapped his name on it. He also had locked it more securely than the other labs on the wing. Teddy made short work of the lock, slipped in, and closed the door. From what he could see in the dim light, Dr. Heinrich had all the latest technological improvements, from electron microscopes to centrifuges to a device that looked like a CT scanner. Teddy shone his flashlight beam around. In addition to shelves of tubes and beakers, crates and cages lined the walls. There were no animals in them, but water bowls indicated there had been. Teddy bypassed all the equipment. He sat at the doctor's desk and switched on his computer. He opened the network folders and scanned the files. None seemed relevant. A global file search for the name Rocky came up empty. Teddy got up from the desk and searched for hard copies. A file cabinet looked like it hadn't been used in years. He checked it anyway. It hadn't. None of the papers in it were current. Teddy struck pay dirt in the coat closet. He pushed the lab coats aside and discovered a safe. The safe was a formidable-looking affair, but still no match for Teddy's skill. A few minutes of work, and he had the door open. In the safe were several file folders. Most were of no interest to him, but one was labeled Virus X. Teddy flipped it open. Virus X was a new strain of virus, X759C4743P, discovered in the lab by Dr. von Heinrich himself. While the virus was not touted as a biological weapon, its attributes were listed. It was a highly contagious and fatal airborne pathogen. A subfolder dealt with the surgical procedure on the dog, the insertion of the vial into his stomach, and the sutures anchoring it in place. The removal of the vial was described in detail, with emphasis on maintaining its integrity to ensure against the slightest leak. Teddy went through the files from top to bottom. Nothing in them implicated René D'Argent. Teddy took the files over to the desk. He skimmed through them again, looking for an appropriate page. He selected one and fed it into the doctor's scanner. He converted it to a Word document he could edit. After the phrase, conducted by Dr. Stefan von Heinrich, he added, under the authorization of René D'Argent. He printed it out and compared it to the original. It was perfect. Teddy stuck the original page in his pocket, replaced it with the altered page, and copied the whole document.
He put the original back in the file folder, labeled Virus X, returned it to the safe, and locked it. He put the full document photocopy in a blank file folder and took that file with him. 84. R&D Enterprises was much easier to break into than Kelso Labs. The only trick was timing the rounds of the night watchman to be able to get in and out without being seen. The lock on the front door was a joke. The alarms were turned off because of the watchman, and the security camera controls were conveniently located behind the reception desk. René D'Argent's offices took up the whole ninth floor. His reception area could have serviced the entire company. It boasted three couches and two large chairs. They weren't the least bit worn. Teddy doubted if they were used much. Reception struck him as the first line of defense. Only the elite few were allowed into the office of his personal secretary. René D'Argent's office was what one would expect of a CEO, from the wooden bar to the flat-screen TV. The desk was a massive oak affair, at once classic and modern. The walls were wood-paneled. The chairs in front of the desk were leather. The lone framed picture behind the desk featured René D'Argent receiving an award from the Prime Minister. The desk had few drawers, two on the left and one on the right. They held nothing of interest, with the exception of an address book. None of the addresses were of business associates. His secretary doubtless kept track of those. Most of the names seemed to be of young women. Unfortunately, the desk was not the type of place where René D'Argent would have kept anything important. Nor was there any such place in the bar. It would appear that all important papers were kept in the outer office, which was arguably not in his possession, or even under his direct supervision. Teddy looked at the picture on the wall. An accolade from the Prime Minister was certainly an honor, but the Silver Fox had undoubtedly received more than his fair share. What was so special about this one? Teddy had long since learned to follow his hunches. He lifted the painting off the wall, revealing a safe. It was not nearly as good a safe as the one in Dr. von Heinrich's lab, but a safe nonetheless. Teddy had it open in seconds. It was full of money, bundles and bundles of 100-euro notes. There must have been close to a 500,000 euros, just mad money to René D'Argent. Teddy took some of it. Not that he needed the money. He just had to make room in the safe. Teddy wrote Virus X on the file folder in magic marker, locked it in the safe, and got out. 85. Teddy hadn't seen Kristen in a few days. He was concerned. There were only a few things that could mean, none of them good. Her cover may have been blown, and she had come to harm. Teddy knew from experience these guys played rough. Or she could be lying low, waiting to strike at the end of the conference. That could only lead to disaster. Whatever she was plotting was sure to throw a monkey wrench into his plans. Teddy never once considered the possibility that she might have simply given up. It just wasn't in her nature. Teddy called Jacques. He caught him at his computer.
What do you need?
Anything going on?
It's pretty quiet.
Anybody at the office show an interest in the conference?
None. It's a non-event. It might as well not be happening.
Is Kristen around?
Norton sent her to London with the ambassador's wife.
Really?
She wasn't happy about it. She tried to foist it off on Valerie, but Norton wouldn't let her. He put his foot down.
It's no secret he's been getting fed up with her lately. Feels she's grown lax about following orders and has a tendency to do whatever she wants.
He's not wrong about that.
When does she get back?
Not until tomorrow, which takes her out of the picture as far as you are concerned. The conference will be over.
Right.
Is that why she was so upset? She was planning to hook up with you.
Why do you say that?
Well, you two seemed close, and you asked about her.
I was asking in terms of the conference.
Of course, Jacques said. You forget, I'm French.
Never, Teddy said.
Teddy hung up the phone feeling better. Kristen was out of the way for the rest of the conference. He could imagine the scene in Norton's office. Having managed to establish an off-the-books relationship with René D'Argent, Kristen could not have been easy to dissuade. Teddy couldn't recall ever feeling so nervous about an operation, but that was only natural. He couldn't recall an operation where there had ever been so much at stake.
86. Teddy dressed up for the farewell cocktail party in Floyd Maitland's finest cowboy regalia, much like Maitland's standard daily outfit, but festooned with bright hand-stitched embroidery. His dinner jacket and blue jeans went together surprisingly well when complemented by his Stetson hat and snakeskin cowboy boots. The only thing missing was his gun belt and Colt revolver. He had no wish to make a scene, merely to come across as a familiar and genial presence. The grand ballroom was decked out for the party with streamers hanging from the ceiling and animal posters adorning the walls. As in the opening party, there were cash bars for liquor and free bars for soft drinks, and a buffet table in the center for finger foods. The fare was better than at the opening party, with such items as shrimp and sliders. The participants were better dressed, too. While the opening was billed as a ceremony, this was billed as a cocktail party, and the guests wore attire fit for the occasion. Teddy pushed his way through the crowd, hoping to accidentally bump into the Syrians. He hoped to learn when their plane was leaving. Flush with victory, they might be less guarded. Teddy saw the Germans sitting at a table off to the side. They were getting drunk. And it was going to be a morose drunk. After failing to purchase the rhino, they had more or less lost interest in the proceedings. Teddy couldn't recall them bidding on anything else. The Palestinians didn't look happy either. Of course, they had lost one of their number, but he was doubtless expendable. They had lost out on the dog, as had the Russians and Chinese. Only the Syrians would be pleased. Teddy spotted them on the far side of the room. They had also dressed for the party. For Fahd, it was a dinner jacket. For the scientists, it was ill-fitting suits. The fireplug hitman wore a suit off the rack, most likely from the plus-size children's department. Teddy maneuvered close enough to have seen them casually without actually looking for them. His face lit up in a smile, and he waved and said, "Howdy!" He walked over, leaned in, and said in a low voice, "Don't worry, I'm not going to talk loud, but I just have to say it. Congratulations. This has been the best convention ever, hasn't it? Worked out great for both of us." "Yes," Fahd said, and turned away to cut off the conversation. Teddy plowed right through the signal. "So when are you taking off? I got a 3 o'clock flight, but you got your own plane. You can leave any time you want. When do you leave for the airport?" Fahd made no attempt to answer and actually took a step away. Teddy tried a few more ploys, but it was no use. Now that the convention was done, Fahd saw no reason to even be civil to the obnoxious Texan. Teddy gave up. There was no help for it. He was just going to have to break into Fahd's room again and search for a note or an email regarding flight time. Teddy went over to the bar and ordered a drink. Ever careful, he didn't want the Syrians to see him leaving right after his chat with Fahd. An alert spy might notice the correlation and realize the Texan had come to the party just to talk to them. It was the type of thing Teddy would notice, and anything Teddy could do, he had to assume could be done. The fireplug assassin didn't look very swift,
but it was impossible to tell what he thought. It would not hurt to appear social. Teddy got himself a bourbon on the rocks and headed happily to the snack table, favoring the company with a liberal sprinkling of coming-throughs and pardon-me-ma'ams. He reached the finger foods, snagged a pig in a blanket, dipped it in mustard, and popped it in his mouth.
"Don't tell me that's French," Teddy said, helping himself to another one.
Teddy spotted one of the Syrian scientists at the bar refilling his drink. It was Dr. Chaim, the zoologist, the more compliant of the two. Teddy set his full drink on the tray of a passing busboy, strode up to the bar, and ordered another bourbon on the rocks. He turned and pretended to see the zoologist for the first time.
"Hey there, buddy," he said heartily, slapping the zoologist on the shoulder. "Show's over. We all go home tomorrow." "What time are you taking off? My plane leaves at 3, but you guys got your own plane, don't you?"
Dr. Chaim was in the middle of paying for his drink, but it was not in him to be rude.
"Dr. Badim and I are on a commercial flight. It doesn't leave until 5. "Oh, that's a shame. Your buddies will be home by then. Aren't they leaving in the morning?"
"Yes, they leave at 11.
"Well, you have a safe trip, buddy."
Teddy saluted him with his drink and headed back toward the snack table. Not that he wanted another pig in a blanket, but from there he could see what Fahd was doing. Teddy was in luck. Fahd's back was turned, and he wasn't paying attention to him at all. Teddy began working his way toward the door. Kristen came in. She was not dressed for the party. She wore conservative, comfortable clothes, suitable for travel. She had clearly just come from the airport, probably had checked her bags with the concierge. As Teddy watched, she wove her way through the crowd. Teddy frowned. Was René D'Argent here? He hadn't seen him, and the silver fox was hardly inconspicuous. Teddy followed Kristen, keeping parallel to her, as she crossed the floor. She was heading toward Fahd, which didn't compute, until she veered off and began weaving a path behind him out of his line of sight. Had she flown back from London for a new mission involving Fahd? As she went by, Teddy saw her slip something into the side pocket of Fahd's jacket. Kristen vanished in the crowd before she could be spotted, let alone identified. Fahd turned to see who had bumped him, but she was gone. He put his hand in his pocket and came out with a folded piece of paper. He unfolded it, read it to himself. He frowned and took a glance around him. Then he tore it in half, tossed it into a garbage bin, and walked away. Teddy pushed his way out of the grand ballroom. He reached the lobby in time to see Kristen pull a carry-on bag out the front door. He would have liked to follow her, but he needed to know what the message said. By the time he returned to the ballroom, the Syrians had made their way across the room. Teddy quickly downed the rest of his bourbon and placed the disposable cup into the garbage can. Nobody noticed the two tiny slips of paper discreetly tucked in his hand. Teddy walked toward the men's room, tipping his hat to fellow conference-goers along the way, went in and closed himself in a stall. He straightened the crumpled pieces of paper and fit them together. It was a note. "It's a go. Leave as scheduled." 87. Teddy went up to his room and took off his Stetson hat, his cowboy boots, and the rest of his Floyd Maitland outfit. He got out his makeup kit, went in the bathroom, and changed his appearance to that of Agent Felix Dressler. He put on a suit and tie and his shoulder holster. He slipped his CIA credentials into his pocket, not that he expected to need them, just out of habit. He went out front and hailed a cab. He got out 2 blocks from Kristen's apartment building and walked the rest of the way. He breezed through the lobby door as another tenant was leaving and went upstairs. Teddy took care not to make a sound picking the lock on the apartment door. He eased it open. Kristen stood there holding a gun. Her mouth fell open.
I thought you left.
I came back.
What are you doing here?
It would appear I'm about to be shot. Kristen looked at the gun in her hand.
Oh,
she lowered it.
Why are you here? I'm pleased to see you, of course, but it's so late. I just got back from London. I was babysitting an ambassador's wife.
That doesn't sound like you.
I tried to get out of it. Norton was being a prick.
I can imagine.
I'm beat. Could we do this tomorrow?
I'm afraid not. Teddy walked her into the living room and sat with her on the couch. He gently took the gun from her hand and laid it on the coffee table.
What's so urgent? Kristen said.
Teddy smiled wistfully. Oh, I think you know.
Believe me, I haven't got a clue.
Oh, I think you do. You're very smart. You played me, and not many people can play me.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Don't embarrass yourself. You're the mole. You knew I was in Paris to find you. That's why you made a play for me, to learn my game. The first night you went through my pockets while I was asleep. You found the keys to the train station lockers. You snuck out, searched the lockers, found the passports, and figured out what I was up to. You said Workman wasn't interested in you, but anybody could see that wasn't true. You used him, ended your relationship, but kept him dancing on a string. You made a play for him to gather intel, pumped him for information, found out he'd searched one of the lockers, got him to tell you the name on the passport. Then you got word to the Syrians to start an internet search for that name, so I'd think Workman was the mole.
Workman was the mole? He's been missing for days. Is that why?
It's no use, Kristen. Teddy took his gun out of his shoulder holster and held it in his lap. If it's any consolation, you're very good at what you do.
Not good enough, apparently.
No one ever is. There's always someone better. Teddy smiled sadly and shook his head.
Why, Kristen? Why?
You know why. I assure you I don't. You were trained by the CIA.
How could you betray them?
The CIA wanted me to be an errand girl. I wanted to be a spy.
Oh, come on.
I met a man in Berlin on one of my babysitting missions. He was the real deal. He was everything I wanted to be.
He was on the other side. What are sides? It's all a game, just different uniforms.
It's not a game, Kristen. These are bad men. You know what they are buying? A deadly virus.
Why is that so bad? We have warheads. We're not going to use them, but having them makes us strong.
That's how you justify it? Teddy shook his head. James Bond is fiction, Kristen. There's no such thing. But you were very good. She smiled a sad smile.
I liked you.
I liked you, too, Teddy said. Kristen lunged for the gun on the coffee table. It broke his heart. She must have known it was hopeless. But she couldn't let herself get arrested. It wasn't in her nature. She was a storybook heroine, a romantic to the last, the type of agent who would have swallowed a poison pill if she'd had one. She grabbed the gun and aimed. He pulled the trigger. 88. Teddy met Dino at Stone's house. Dino was surprised to see him.
You are Felix Dressler again?
It's a long story. Everything set on your end?
Pretty much. The handler's getting antsy, wants to know when he can go home.
Probably tomorrow, but you can't tell him that.
It seems like there's a lot of things I can't tell people.
That's what the spy business is all about. Is the prefect going along?
He sees the wisdom of catching the Syrians at the handler's house, but he still likes the idea of stopping them at the airport.
You pointed out that a photo op on the runway would tip off the Syrians, whereas a nice shot of the Paris prefect marching René d'Argent off in handcuffs would be all over the evening news.
I think I phrased it a little more tactfully.
I'm sure you did, Teddy said, and you suggested obtaining a search warrant for René d'Argent's safe.
Yes, I did. He wanted to know why.
And you said it was so you wouldn't have to take credit for it.
That seemed to be the best answer.
Okay, I got the time for him. It's 11 o'clock. He should hit the handler's house, the doctor's lab, and René d'Argent's office exactly at 11.
I'll pass it along.
Okay, I won't see you again until it's over. If you want to grab a ride home on the Strategic Services jet, I'm sure they wouldn't mind.
Are you flying with them?
Not likely, Teddy said. I wouldn't want to get in a discussion with the handler.
I see your point. I think I'll fly commercial, too. If we're on the same flight, should I acknowledge you?
Teddy smiled. If you recognize me. 89. Fahd and Aziz waited on the runway in front of Hangar 47. A panel van drove up and the handler and the goons got out.
"Where's the dog?" Fahd said.
The handler jerked his thumb.
"In the van."
He led Fahd around to the back and pointed through the window. The dog was in a crate.
"Take him out," Fahd said.
"Not on the runway," the hangar pilot said. "You drive the van into the hangar and load the dog, then I'll tow the plane out for you to board."
"You don't leave until we do," Fahd told the handler.
"We'll wait until the plane is away in case there is any problem," the handler said.
"Good," Fahd said. "Load the dog."
The handler and the goons got back in the van and drove into the hangar. The handlers slipped a leash on the dog's collar and led him out of the van. The goons folded up the crate, carried it onto the plane, and set it up. The handler put the dog in the crate and threw in a couple of treats. While the dog gobbled them up, he draped a blanket over the crate.
"Night-night, Rocky."
The handler and the goons left the dog on the plane and drove out of the hangar. The luggage hatch opened and Teddy Fay crawled out, pushing his backpack ahead of him. He was somewhat cramped from his having been in the compartment for more than an hour. He stood up, stretched, and lifted up the blanket.
"Hi, Barclay. How you doing?"
Teddy had treats in his hand. Barclay slurped them gratefully. Teddy took a leash out of his backpack, opened the crate door, and snapped the leash on Barclay's collar. He let the dog out of the crate, told him to sit, and gave him a treat. Teddy shoved his backpack into the crate, closed the door, and draped the blanket back down over it. Teddy pushed the hatch open wide, and with a handful of treats, led the dog into the baggage compartment. He closed the hatch behind him, plunging them into darkness.
"Easy, boy, it's okay."
A sudden jarring told him the pilot had hooked up the tow to pull the jet out of the hangar. He could feel the plane start to move. Teddy pushed the hatch open and dropped to the ground.
"Come on, boy, jump."
Barclay leapt off the plane. Teddy caught him and helped him land gently and quietly. The jet was moving away. Teddy slammed the luggage hatch. He pulled Barclay off to one side, out of the line of sight. Fahd was practically tapping his foot, waiting for the jet to be towed into position. Though Kristen had assured him everything was fine, Fahd didn't believe in tempting fate. Hanging out on a runway was not a good idea.
"No nonsense taking off," he told the pilot. "You don't need to go through a lot of procedures. Just start the plane and go. Once we're in the air, you can do anything you like. Just get it off the ground."
"As soon as it's ready," the pilot said.
The hangar pilot unhitched the tow and opened the cabin door.
All set. Go ahead and board.
Come on, come on, Fodd said, herding Aziz ahead of him. Let's go.
The Syrians boarded the plane and took their seats. The pilot climbed into the cockpit.
Well, come on, start the engine, Fodd said.
They're loading your luggage. I can't start the engine until they're clear.
What's keeping them?
They're loading it now.
The hangar pilot closed the cargo door.
Okay, they're finished, the pilot said. Sit down and buckle up. Here we go.
Fodd returned to his seat. Before he sat down, he looked at the crate in the back of the plane. It was covered by a blanket.
Check the dog, he said to Aziz.
Without changing expression, the little man managed to look put upon. He got up and went to the back of the plane. He lifted the blanket off the crate. He blinked. The dog was gone. Fodd turned in his seat to look at the dog. Aziz looked stricken. He pulled a backpack out of the crate.
What's that? Fodd demanded. Where's the dog?
Aziz reached into the backpack and pulled out a package. His eyes widened in alarm. He held it up for Fodd to see. It was plastic explosives with a remote-control detonator. Crouched in the bay doors of the hangar, holding on tightly to the dog, Teddy Fay pushed the button on his cell phone. The plane blew up. 90. A squad of police officers burst into René Dargent's office. Paris Prefect Clément Moreau came striding in after them, a triumphant smile on his face.
René Dargent, I have a warrant for your arrest.
René Dargent's mouth fell open. He rose from his chair in astonishment.
On what charge? Terrorism, treason, murder. There are more, but those are probably the ones you will be most concerned with. After you've been convicted of treason, it's hard to focus on your other charges.
Have you lost your mind?
Not at all. At this very moment, my men are arresting Dr. von Heinrich in his laboratory, as well as seizing the dog and arresting the Syrian buyers. By the time they get done talking, you'll be a very sorry individual.
The prefect's cocky boast was only half true. His men were indeed seizing the doctor, but his other squad had just burst in on an empty house. He was lucky he had another string for his bow.
It's their word against mine. You've got nothing against me.
The prefect pointed his finger at the framed picture of René Dargent and the Prime Minister.
Get that wall safe open.
91. Teddy and Barclay walked out the main gate. With a plane burning on the runway, no one noticed them. Dino was waiting in his car. He helped Teddy load Barclay into the crate he'd just purchased, and they took off.
The prefect's going to be pissed, Dino said.
Not as pissed as he would have been if he'd stopped the plane. He'd have caught the Syrians with no dog.
I know it, and you know it, but he doesn't know it, and that's why he's going to be pissed.
Well, Teddy said, it's a good thing we're leaving Paris.
You didn't tell me we'd be leaving ahead of the posse.
It's not as bad as all that, Dino. He's still got a case against René Dargent, which I'm sure matters more to him than all the Syrians in the world put together. They may not have the dog, but they're squeezing his scientist, who's bound to roll over on him, and there's sure to be a paper trail linking René Dargent to the virus.
There's sure to be?
Dino said. Count on it.
Dino pulled up in front of the apartment. Teddy got the dog out of the crate, walked him upstairs, and knocked on the apartment door. The handler opened it.
Hi, Teddy said. I just took Barclay out for a walk.
Here he is. He seems fine.
The handler stared at him.
What the hell?
And I've got good news. You can go home.
The handler was looking back and forth from Barclay to Rocky. But, and you're taking two dogs home. If there's an extra charge, it's all right. Just put it on the bill. We got another crate. It's out in the car. I hope the dogs get along. I'm sure they will. They're both pretty easygoing. The handler was dumbfounded. So, I'll take you to the airport this afternoon. You could go now, but it's a little busy out there, and it's the absolute wrong time to show up with a dog. Teddy smiled. Enjoy your stay in Paris? 92. Millie met Lance on the White House lawn.
Our friend is coming home.
Oh?
He found the mole.
Really?
Her name is Kristen Rowan.
The Syrian agents brought her onto their payroll to ensure the CIA wouldn't interfere with an international conspiracy taking place at Larrington Hotel.
At Larrington? Does Stone know that? He will. It's in no way his or Marcel Dubois' fault.
A convention for the preservation of endangered species turned out to be a front for a biological weapons deal. That's why finding the mole was just the tip of the iceberg. The real mission was putting the terrorists out of operation.
And I couldn't have been told this?
I didn't know. He only tells me what he wants me to know. Or rather, what he wants you to know. So, the good news is the Syrians have been neutralized, and the threat of a biological weapon has been erased. Even if no one knows it. At least, no one but you.
Yet, conveniently, there's no proof any of this occurred.
Well, there will be.
What? Our friend is sending the sample of the virus back to you for our scientists to study and create a vaccine. Along with the dog. Your friend's dog is fine. The other dog needs an operation.
Other dog?
Luckily, the dog's not infected. The virus is in a vial sewn into the lining of the dog's stomach. A simple operation can remove the vial, and the dog will be good to go, which is nice because Barclay seems to like him. Your friend may wind up with two dogs.
Lance blinked.
Run that by me again.
93. Teddy finished swimming laps. He climbed out of his pool, dried off, and relaxed in a deck chair. His cell phone rang. He picked it up. Hello? It was Lance.
Do you know who this is?
How did you find me? I have a new phone with a new number.
I'm head of the CIA.
I suppose you have some resources?
Lance exhaled. Do you do things just to annoy me? Did I send you to Paris on a hopeless mission?
It wasn't hopeless. You actually did it.
And yet you sound annoyed.
Well, why you couldn't have done it without buying a €500,000 rhinoceros is beyond me.
I don't know what you're grousing about. I saved you $275 million on the dog.
Did I ask you to buy an infected dog?
He's not infected.
So why am I reading reports of how the Paris police foiled an international arms deal involving bioterrorists?
You wanted the glory. I thought you guys didn't deal in that.
Well, you can blame Dino. He let the prefect take credit in exchange for doing all he wanted. It seemed a fair exchange to me, but you be the judge.
What you can take credit for is the rhinoceros.
The Tanzanian government is eternally grateful to the CIA for their generous donation of a rare black rhino. That gesture bought an awful lot of goodwill.
A €500,000 worth?
Have you seen that rhino? He's a real heartbreaker.
Teddy could practically hear Lance gnashing his teeth.
You have one more expense. Oh, Christ, what else did you buy? Agent Workman was collateral damage.
You can't acknowledge how he actually died, so you can make anything up. He was killed in the line of duty and should be singled out for bravery. If he has a family, they should be generously compensated.
How did he actually die?
I shot him. Lance sucked in his breath.
Why are you telling me this?
So you'll never ask me again. Hang on a minute. I've got another call.
You're putting the director of the CIA on hold?
Because I'm a nice guy. A jerk would hang up on you.
Teddy silenced Lance's angry protests by pressing the hold button and picked up the other call.
Hello? It was Peter Barrington.
Billy, I heard you were back. Want to make a movie?
Hell yes, Teddy said. Let me put you on hold a second, Peter. I've got to get rid of a pest.
This is Tony Roberts. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Skin Game by Stuart Woods and Parnell Hall. This program was directed by John McElroy. Executive producer, Diane McKiernan. Text copyright 2019 by Stuart Woods. Production copyright 2019, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved. Teddy Fay finished his 20 laps in the terrace pool. He pulled himself out and sat on the deck, drinking in the morning sun. His broken leg had nearly healed, remarkable considering the amount of stress he'd subjected it to before allowing it to be put in a cast, or rather, put back in a cast. Extenuating circumstances had forced him to cut off the original cast in order to deal with a life-or-death situation. He'd been a good boy since, even followed his rehab regimen. The fact that he liked swimming didn't hurt. He got up, sat in a deck chair, and poured himself a cool glass of lemonade. Teddy enjoyed the three-story split-level Hollywood house on Mulholland Drive that he'd purchased in the name of Billy Barnett. Teddy had three identities. That is, three current identities. In the course of his career, he had played many roles, occasionally more than one at a time, but they were usually temporary. As Billy Barnett, he had risen through the ranks from production assistant to producer at Centurion Studios. As Mark Weldon, he was a stuntman who had evolved into a character actor who specialized in playing villains. As Teddy Fay, he was not known at all. His cell phone rang. Teddy scooped it up.
Hello? Billy Barnett?
Yes?
This is Lance Cabot.
Teddy nearly dropped the phone. Lance Cabot was the head of the CIA. Teddy had worked for Lance once before going rogue and killing people who deserved to die. Lance had organized a global manhunt for him, but Teddy was so elusive they soon elevated him to the top of the most wanted list. When even a presidential pardon failed to cool the agency's ardor, Teddy changed his name and dropped out of sight. He'd been rumored dead. Most agents subscribed to the rumor. Teddy said,
"Why would the head of the CIA be calling a Hollywood film producer?"
"I'm not calling you in your producer capacity."
Teddy paused.
"Go on."
"We have a problem in Paris."
"Oh?"
"We have a mole, which is ridiculous. There's nothing happening in Paris that would warrant an enemy power planting a mole at that branch. The agency was tracking only one individual recently, a low-level Syrian agent named Hassan Hamwi. Recently, he suddenly dropped out of sight, as if he knew he was under surveillance, knew when, how, and by whom. That's why we think we have a mole."
"And you want someone to handle the situation? Well, I'm not the man you're looking for. I happen to know you went out of your way to try to kill him, so I'd hardly care to be that guy. But if you want me to apply my meager talents to the situation, perhaps we can work something out."
"You want money?"
"Hardly. I can't be bought because I have all I need. I'm not above doing a favor for a friend, but you hardly fit into that category."
"You're still alive, aren't you?"
"What do you mean by that?"
If I wanted to, finding and killing you wouldn't be hard. After all, I made this phone call.
Is that a threat?
Not at all. I'm pointing it out as a token of friendship, since such things seem to matter.
What would I have to do?
Go undercover, assume a new identity. I know you've played everybody from a bag lady to a bank president, but this might be sort of a stretch.